Hi there. Well, let's get started, and we'll fold people in as they arrive late. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct our daily work of daily lives. It's hard to believe that we're almost to the end of another school year and almost to the end of our last, we have two, this one and then our next one, and I'll just pass that around. Patrick can throw it that way and it'll work its way around, is Scott Peters is coming in on the 21st of April, I'll give it to you in a second, talking about the sound of caulking irons to the smell of fiberglass working in Michigan's boatyards, 1870 to 2000. Scott wrote a book called Making Waves, Michigan's Boatbuilding Industry, 1865 to 2000. And he's a very, very interesting guy. He works downtown at the Michigan History Museum. And he's very, very compelling in terms of the story he tells and a very, very good presenter. So I hope that you're able to come out for that. I would commend to you that we've just turned over almost all of our exhibits are new here in the building. So do check out our quilt exhibit as well as the two photographic exhibits. If you've never seen subway cars dropped into the Atlantic Ocean, make sure that you hit the ground floor. And then the pictures of weather and icebergs are just fabulous on the first floor, if you haven't seen that yet. So today, I'd like to introduce one of my colleagues. When I say one of my colleagues, I was lucky enough to spend 6 months at Georgetown University on their faculty at the Kalmanovitz Initiative on Labor and the Working Poor, which is a very, very interesting group of folks, and it was just an absolute delight, absolute pleasure to be able to hang out with them. And but before I introduce Patrick, let me thank Linda Kaloff and the folks from the Animal Studies Program for their co-sponsorship and absolute friendship throughout the years of this series and generally. So today, Patrick Dixon is here. Patrick got his PhD from Georgetown working with the wonderful labor historian Joe McCartan, who heads up the Kalmanovitz Initiative. And Patrick's dissertation basically is right in the heart of what you're about to hear today. You'll notice from his accent that he hails from the other side of the Atlantic. Before he came to Georgetown to do his degree, he was at both at Sussex and at the University College of London for earlier degrees before he came here. And the Kalmanovitz Initiative actually works with students to place them with labor internships and other things out of KI. They also do a variety of pieces of research. And generally, they're a fascinating, fascinating group of colleagues, and it was my absolute pleasure to be part of them. So today, Patrick is talking on the topic, negotiating taste, consumers, and workers in the changing poultry industry, 1870 through 1990. So please help me welcome Patrick Dixon to our Daily Work of Daily Lives.
Good. Thank you, John, and thanks for bringing me here, and I'd like to thank you all for coming out today to listen to what I had to talk about. I was going to talk to you today about changes that take place in the poultry business between 1970 and 1990. Now, on the face of it, that might not necessarily sound the most fascinating topic. Like any industry, in the latter half of the 20th century, there are many changes in the types of machinery and in the efficiency of the poultry business, but I won't get into the sort of details and the minutiae of innovations like the Beehive Model S76 deboner, even though it was the most simple, rugged, dependable, easy-to-operate deboning equipment on the market with an in-feed capacity of 10,000 pounds per hour. So, important as it may have been, that's not where I was going to focus. The reason I find the poultry business interesting in this period is I think it's informative in both shaping and in responding to Americans' evolving conceptions about ideas like diet and lifestyle and exercise and physical well-being at this time. In many ways, poultry is a brutal business, which is located in many states which have the most negative views towards government oversight. But in this period, it developed many of the sort of methods to facilitate what Americans, I think, considered to be a good life. It's fairly common in books about poultry, if you ever find a book about poultry, for them to quote Herbert Hoover's 1928 ill-fated promise that he was going to provide a chicken in every pot. Hoover wasn't the first to utter this statement. In the 1500s, Henry IV of France said, "I want there to be no peasant in my realm so poor that he will not have a chicken in his pot every Sunday." Well, that might not have been achieved at that time in France either, but the second part of what Hoover said is often overlooked. The second part of that phrase, it was a chicken in every pot and a car in every backyard to boot. Speed and plentitude. In 1928, these dual aspirations, they seemed attainable, I think, and on the sort of and a sort of landmark on the near horizon. The car representing freedom and mobility and master over geography, and the chicken dinner, something which in the 1920s was an expensive indulgence, but which in time, through the sort of democratic proliferation of consumables, could be a nightly occurrence. It could be something that was not only cooked in a pot or an oven, but it could be summoned in 2 to 3 minutes with the power of microwave technology. But these goals, they came at a price, and I think the aspirations of scientists and industrialists to provide these meals, to provide a new diet of low-cost chicken, played a central role in the sort of development of what, by the turn of the 20th century, became a public health crisis in a way of issues of obesity and diabetes, which in many cases remain unresolved. Now, the place I'd like to start in this story is the first opening of a Wendy's restaurant in Columbus, Ohio in 1969. Now that's pretty strange too. It was, after all, a hamburger restaurant, very deliberately so. Yet I think the changes that took place in the restaurant industry often sort of foreshadowed the changes that took place in people's private spaces. Least of all in a country in which people dined out at some of the highest rates in the world. In 1960, around 20% of meals were eaten out of the home. This was in the 30s by 1980s. By 2000, 40% of meals in this country were eaten outside the home. Now, the founder of Wendy's, Dave Thomas, wasn't new to the restaurant business. He'd been a chef in the Korean War, and when he was discharged, he went to work at a hobby house in Fort Wayne, Indiana. There he'd cook grilled chicken, potato salads, pickles, and rye bread. Well, sometimes someone would come in and say they didn't like rye bread, so the restaurant owner would go out and buy some bread rolls, and they think, well, bread rolls are popular, so we'll add bread rolls to the menu. Then someone might ask for some eggs, and, you know, eggs, well, why not? Everyone likes eggs too, so they'd add eggs to the menu. Well, it was from this vantage point that Thomas developed a fairly straightforward set of ideas that he'd bring into play in what became a full frontal assault on McDonald's in the early 70s. So what were these ideas? Well, he believed that complicated menus led to complicated operations. Simple menus led to speed and efficiency. This wasn't new. McDonald's had done the same. Glenn Bell, who was the founder of Taco Bell, also agreed. He said, "Don't sell everything your customers ask for. Decide what you're going to sell, then make it the best it can be." In the age of the Vietnam War and Watergate, Thomas developed an easily recognizable aesthetic that he believed harkened to a sort of simpler era. He had an old Western style typeface, and the icon of the icon of Wendy's was a picture of his daughter with red braided hair. So he'd aimed at adults who were sort of tired of cynicism. And unlike McDonald's, he'd prepare freshly made burgers on the premises every day, no frozen foods. There'd be no clowns, no Ronald McDonald, no pitching to children. But most importantly, he challenged the idea of value. Now, beef accompanied by bread was pretty much a staple of the American diet since the early settlers arrived. And Thomas liked to play upon these assumptions. He said that Wendy's intended to sell better hamburgers than McDonald's or Burger King at a cheaper price per ounce. Thomas's burgers, they'd be bigger. Whereas McDonald's burgers were 1/10 of a pound in size, Thomas would serve you a 1/4 pounder. If you wanted to pay a bit more, he could add 2 burgers. You could have a 1/2 pounder. If you really wanted 3, they could do that too. Wendy's would later launch a famous advertising campaign where a lady opens an enormous bread bun and there's a small patty inside, and she exclaims, "Where's the beef?" This became kind of a phrase that entered into the lexicon. Wendy's would label McDonald's the home of the big bun. So they'd really compete in terms of, we're offering more meat, more value, you're going to get more for less. American consumers were programmed to sort of think of things in these terms. What offers the best value for the best amount? This made sense. Later, PepsiCo would enter the fast food business. They'd purchase Taco Bell. They'd later purchase Kentucky Fried Chicken. They whole hog bought into the same set of objectives in changing the quick service food business to one where you had to turn out as large an amount of product as possible at tight margins. Your food, you know, the food, it had to meet a certain threshold, but when you're dealing with meals that consist of beef, bread, potatoes, and carbonated drinks, the quality didn't have to be that high, right? I mean, it wasn't the difference between buying like a Chevy and a Cadillac. It was meat and potatoes. It's only really in the 2000s that, in the wake of films like Super Size Me, does a sort of critique develop of this approach to selling more for less. And, you know, the sort of relentless upselling of fast food restaurants starts to take a step back to some degree. So this formula implemented by Dave Thomas at Wendy's proves to be really successful. In 1969, he has one restaurant. 10 years later, he has 1,800 restaurants. In the same time, Burger King, Domino's, Pizza Hut, Kentucky, they're all growing at an impressive rate, but McDonald's still holds the lead by the end of the decade. They have 2,000 stores in 1972. It's up to 4,000 by 1976. By 1980, there are 6,000 McDonald's worldwide. So you can see in this period, there's this enormous infrastructure that's developed and that creates thousands and thousands of restaurants in every corner of the country. Many industry analysts, restaurant experts, said in the early 70s that there were more restaurants than the market could sustain. There were just enough already. They were way off. But what does this have to do with chicken, you're going to be asking? This is a talk about chicken, not beef, right? Well, what makes Thomas so interesting in many ways is his dogged determination not to sell chicken at Wendy's. He says, everybody likes burgers. It's as simple as that. Everyone likes burgers. Why would you need to sell anything else? He says, I can't stand chicken. Industry experts would say that without some sort of increase in diversity, he would start to lose customers. But Thomas says, those guys believe in the minority veto. They believe that if 4 people are going out to eat together, and if one wants chicken, the group won't go to a place that serves hamburgers alone. I just don't think that people behave this way. For one thing, people eat together because they want to eat together, not because of a particular menu item. He concludes, I'll need good reason before Wendy's starts frying fish or chicken. As the 70s come to an end, though, the wheel turns, the market changes. These burger empires were dependent on this massive supply of cheap commodities. So supermarkets and fast and supermarkets and full service restaurants, in some ways they're sort of sheltered by the, sheltered from price spikes in one commodity because they offer such a wide range of products. But Wendy's, McDonald's, Burger King, they're really heavily dependent on there being a supply of low-cost beef. So inflation had been nagging through the 70s. It reaches double-digit figures in 1974 and 1975. Now, when inflation cuts in and when prices rise for feed in cattle, cattlemen tend to often dump beef onto the market rather than pay the costs of the new feed. So what you end up with is a short-term drop in the price of beef, but over the medium term, the price tends to go up. It takes a while to sort of replenish your stock, to raise cows and feed them, right? That's kind of what happens. By 1979, the price of beef goes up rapidly by a third, and restaurants like Wendy's and McDonald's are quickly faced with the dilemma of either turning the price over onto consumers or seeing their profits diminish. What do? So they turn to an industry that's highly technological, that's scientific, that's fast and that's efficient and that's been 40 years in the making. Beyond Kentucky Fried Chicken, there isn't great penetration of chicken into the fast food restaurant industry. But what they needed, to adapt to this price hike and to this changing market was to have the right products. Chicken on the bone, that didn't seem to be sort of befitting for a Wendy's or McDonald's, right? So while they needed to sort of change what was on offer, they wanted to keep the speed and the simplicity. At the same time, they needed to adapt. There was a new idea that was being talked about by restaurant industry experts by the turn of the 1980s. That's this phrase, menu diversity. So they had to embrace menu diversity. Now, Ray Kroc at McDonald's had been a bit of an experimenter before. He'd introduced the Egg McMuffin, that worked. Then he'd introduced the Filet-O-Fish sandwich. That had been a success too. He introduced something called the Hula Burger. Not such a success, didn't last. So 1980, they introduced something called the McChicken sandwich. This is a 95-cent sandwich. It's a breaded chicken steak with a slice of lettuce, tartar sauce in a sesame seed bun. It's a flop, doesn't work either. A couple of reporters in Lancaster, Pennsylvania go and survey 100 people. They do their own experiment on this sandwich. They decide it's, quote, a loser. Why don't they like the McChicken sandwich? The processed chicken is so bland that you simply can't taste it, says one of them. You can taste the bun, lettuce, and sauce all right, but there could be anything inside that greasy breading. Even when we took a hunk of the breaded patty out of the sandwich and tried it, we still couldn't taste the chicken, they said. With disappointing sales, McDonald's realizes by 1983, to paraphrase from the Wall Street Journal, that the McChicken sandwich wasn't going to fly. Consumer tastes of the 80s were quickly evolving, and if the burger giants didn't do something, then this market was going to slip away from them. A diet of hamburgers, french fries, and milkshakes just no longer satisfies the fast food consumer, says the president of Jack in the Box in 1982. Jane Wallace, who's a restaurant industry journalist, says, an ever more demanding public has tired of the concepts that once lured them to eat at new places. Themes that were considered clever have become cliches. People are becoming more nutritionally aware. If you read young ladies' magazines from the 50s and 60s, which I did for research purposes, then, you know, weight loss isn't something that's approached, and it's something to be addressed by careful diet alone. The best you might get some pictures of sort of exercises, you know, that can be done in one's bedroom, but there's no getting a pair of sneakers and putting some earplugs in and running around the neighborhood. That wasn't a goer. You know, Sony Walkman, that's not introduced till 1979, and, you know, the cost of batteries is... So there's an increase in interest in fitness and leading a healthy lifestyle that's taking over in the late 70s as they transition into the 80s. In in an LA Times feature in 1981, there's a journalist called William Overend, and he profiles what he refers to as the gym generation, an approach to the physique that had left Muscle Beach and was consuming Southern California and was set to spread across the country. Overend described the body temples of the gym generation, which he said were mirrored palaces of chrome and glass with new miracle machines to transform long-neglected bodies into marvels of toned flesh. The gymnasium craze, I think you could argue, was in part a response to the heaviness of the American diet. We all eat better these days. The standard of living is higher, and so we take in a lot of fat, explained Rudy Smith, who was the president of Holiday Spas Health Clubs of California. More people worked in office environments and did less physical jobs. Smith continued, if we don't burn that off, it turns into ugly body fat. Just watching Rocky racing up those stairs and getting stronger, that really was one of the turning points for all of us, he says. So the domains of bodybuilders and professional athletes, something that had been quite niche occupations, had quickly become affordable and available to many Americans. As this occurred, definitions of sort of physical attraction and physical appeal as displayed in magazines evolved, and ideas of sort of toned and clearly defined muscle structures increasingly came to be advertised as the height of attractiveness. So the poultry business is one of the primary beneficiaries of this turn to gymnasiums at the expense of fatty red meats. Chicken seems to have almost universal appeal, wrote a journalist in Restaurant Business magazine. Today, more than ever, chicken is perceived as lighter, leaner, and more nutritious than red meat. It was pretty straightforward for the business. For the food operator, chicken has relatively low food cost, is stable in price, readily available, and incredibly versatile, he said. The beef business is concerned at this point. The beef business is concerned by 1981. Chickens are stampeding our beef customers, one guy says. They were worried that by the end of the decade, beef would have been overtaken by chicken. A spokesman for the meat board asserted, beef is much different than what our grandparents and maybe parents put on the table. We're trying to overcome some misconceptions. They were struggling. Consumers were ready for it. S. Truett Caffey, the founder of Chick-fil-A, he was doing pretty well. KFC was growing too, but the burger bars were being left behind. So how would they capture this new market? Where would they find the solution to this? The correct answer to this is Ithaca, New York. Cornell University food scientist Robert Baker had been working on poultry issues since the 1950s. Beginning in the early 60s, Robert Baker starts to develop a critique of the way in which food was thrown away and wasted, and he was concerned about the environmental implications of this and with, you know, the effects on a hungry planet with rapidly growing populations. Up until the 50s, most chicken was bought in what was described as New York dressed style. This was, you know, a chicken that had its head cut off, it was feathered, the insides were removed, put in a bag and put inside the chicken. Some of you are familiar. By the 60s and 70s, people are increasingly accustomed to buying just discrete chicken parts, though. Two breasts, four legs, six wings. This left around, you know, a lot of parts of the chicken that were previously consumed, and now, you know, no one wanted to buy them. Not many people wanted to go in and buy chicken hearts. At the same time, the technology was evolving that allowed, you know, you to mechanically reclaim parts of the chicken as meat that hadn't been possible before. So you could more efficiently sort of strip the carcass of all the edible parts. In creating new meals, Robert Baker aimed to provide affordable dietary needs while affecting a more efficient food system that could develop out of a greater concern for scarce environmental resources. He didn't set out to devise notorious chicken products, though his family had raised Rhode Island Reds in upstate New York. He received a BS in pomology from Cornell. Then he says, I guess I fell in love with chickens. Though he began studying botany, he says, I changed later on because I thought the future was brighter in chicken than it was in fruit. After completing a master's in agricultural studies at Penn State in the late 40s, he'd returned to New York, where he'd head up the poultry extension service at Cornell. With the rise of convenience foods in the post-war era, Robert Baker sought to apply the lessons of science and of chemistry to develop an improved food system. He was particularly concerned at the rate of food waste at this time. He said, at least 8% of all commercial bread stales and is thrown away, never reaching the consumer. A fourth of all fruits and vegetables harvested are lost through spoilage between harvest and the time of purchase. Then there was the fishing industry, which was a particular cause of concern. Did you know that each year we waste or underutilize millions of tons of fish? He wrote in 1978. It's estimated that as much as 70% of the fish in the oceans are underutilized. The same could be said for lake-dwelling fish, too. Why were fish underutilized? What was the cause of this? Some have tiny needle-like bones which make them difficult to eat, he said. Others had unfortunate names like the sucker, the crappie, the cancer fish, that made them hard to sell. Still others were considered too small to be worth the effort to prepare them. Then there were chickens. The necks and giblets of broilers are placed in the body cavities of the carcasses and told to consumers, who often throw them away, Baker said. If both necks and giblets were further processed, a potential £300 million of neck meat and £487 million of giblets, or a total £787 million of edible meat would be available. He went on to talk about Leghorns. Leghorns are a sort of fast, aggressive breed of chicken that lays a lot of eggs. The Leghorns are the sort of number one egg-laying hen. Well, he says of Leghorns, they were very popular for meat, and I can remember they're selling for as much as 45 cents a pound on the farm. At present, Leghorn fowl are bringing about 7 cents a pound on the farm, and they have been as low as 2 cents. So you've got this enormous egg industry, which, you know, at a certain point, a chicken stops laying eggs as quickly as it used to, and then it's sold for meat. But those weren't being made use of. This happens at a time when you have food shortages in various parts of the world. There are really serious famines in East Africa, parts of West Africa, in Bangladesh. In 1978, Jimmy Carter sets up a presidential commission on world hunger. This is a really serious issue. The USDA, the US Department of Agriculture, issues a yearbook every year, and the subtitle of the yearbook in 1981 was, Will There Be Enough Food? At the same time, there was a popular scientist called Paul Ehrlich, who writes a book called The Population Bomb, which becomes a bestseller. It shows that the periods of time in which it takes for the world's population to double were becoming smaller and smaller. It'd taken 1,000 years for the world's population to double to a total of 500 million from year 650 to 1650. By 1930, there were 2 billion people, meaning a 100% increase in just the previous 80 years from 1850. The global population was set to reach 4 billion by 1974. So if you could take the 30% or so of a bird that was underutilized and make it into something appealing, then you could alleviate this problem of food shortages to some degree. This is what he believed. So by 1968, Baker's developed 38 different chicken products, from chicken franks to chicken patties, and they'd achieved, you know, a sort of modest level of success. And he'd sort of refined the methods of this by trial and error. If a chicken patty turned out grey when you cooked it, then people wouldn't eat it. Similarly, if it lost its shape in the oven, or if it turned to mush when it was defrosted, then people wouldn't eat that too. So how did you strike the right balance between chewiness and tenderness? How did you prevent it from having a warmed-up flavour? The answers to this lay in different variables. How much chicken skin would you add to your product? How much water? How much fat? It required a complicated mixture of additives to keep the fat suspended, to keep the food an edible colour, to maintain the tensile strength of the meat so that the product would hold together. Baker never charged anyone for any of these recipes. He just thought this was for the good of humanity, and he published them in scientific journals and hoped that someone would make use of them. So in 1980, with the chicken McSandwich, the chicken McSandwich is failing. Chefs at McDonald's provide a proposal based on Robert Baker's ideas, on his scientific designs, a chicken snack food composed of mechanically reclaimed meat. They tested it in select markets in 1980 with limited televisual promotions. In the 1,600 markets in which they test this new product, they see 8% sales. That's without a major nationwide ad campaign. By June 1983, with the help of Tyson's Foods, a major chicken producer, they're ready to go nationwide with this new product. So what was the new amazing product that would turn around the fortunes of the burger chains in the early 1980s? They called it the Chicken McNugget, that's right. Served with ample portions of barbecue sauce, honey mustard, sweet and sour, the limited taste of the McNugget was hidden. The unappetizing appearance of mechanically reclaimed meat was simply obscured by coating it in bread. It was an amazing success. Within months of the national rollout, one McDonald's executive said, "We sold enough chicken product to position us firmly as the world's second largest chicken restaurant after Kentucky Fried Chicken. The frozen boneless chicken business in North America has gone crazy, bananas, since the introduction of the Chicken McNugget last year." A McDonald's vice president says, "McNugget sales are running beyond our most optimistic budget projections right now. Our projection in the first place were wild. We had run our own tests on the US data we had, but we've had to revise all of those figures upwards." McDonald's had managed to present an item that successfully met the needs of multiple eating trends that were simultaneously in the ascendance. They'd introduced menu diversity at the restaurants, providing a lean white meat item over red, while at the same time providing a snack that could be fit into increasingly irregular dining patterns. "McDonald's has really started something," wrote Restaurants and Institutions magazine. "The success of its McNuggets line has rubbed off on the entire chicken fast food segment." Before long, chicken nuggets were on sale everywhere, from Burger King to Kentucky Fried Chicken, to children's meals at full service restaurants, to frozen food aisles in supermarkets. Even Wendy's would end up selling chicken nuggets. Dave Thomas — why would we sell anything but burgers, Dave Thomas? Everyone loves burgers. He says, "As our customers' tastes have changed, Wendy's has adapted." Over time, the sense of wonder at this popular new product would diminish as consumers started to question the nugget's contents. Scientific tests would find bone meal in some nuggets and other types of filler. They'd become tarnished and considered a bad meat. They became among the most popular items in school canteens, and this would become the center point of a campaign by celebrity chef Jamie Oliver to try and improve school lunch menus. They became McNuggets, in some ways, you know, competing with Pop-Tarts, competing with Funyuns, became seen as the sort of epitome of poor quality processed foods. They weren't made from the prime cuts of meat that Americans were used to. That said, people had eaten giblets for thousands of years. People had eaten necks for thousands of years. At the same time, you could argue that the salt content, the fat content, and the range of different additives required to make a chicken McNugget tasty diminished or undermined all nutritional values it might have had. Similarly, people had eaten leggings and other breeds of chicken for as long as people had eaten chicken. The idea that the enormous, super fast growing Cornish cross breed of chicken, which is the main type of chicken raised today for the poultry industry, the idea that that was an inherently a better quality or a better type of bird might need some questioning. This also proved to be an enormous boon to the poultry industry. It presented a gateway whereby they could turn chicken parts and old egg layers that had been worth pennies, that had been only good for chicken soup or for animal food, dog food, they could turn these into profitable products that cost very little to make. So what became known as further processed chicken products positioned the industry to overtake beef as America's most popular meat in the early 90s. This was helped by a light touch approach to regulation in the 1980s, combined with a business-friendly USDA that allowed poultry plants to increase line speeds to sort of reckless rates, which led to and continues to lead to an epidemic of repetitive motion industries to hands, to wrists of workers that remains a problem. Tyson Foods is based in Springdale, Arkansas, and the Tyson family were longtime Democrats. They weren't hurt too much when a former Democratic governor of Arkansas was elected to the nation's highest office in the early 90s. They had good connections there. And as welfare reform came in the mid-90s, as some single mothers were forced to look for work if they were in rural areas, sometimes the only job available was in a poultry plant. So while stories of deindustrialization have abounded when you're talking about this period, the poultry industry grew and grew and grew in mostly small southern towns. Of the 426 poultry slaughtering facilities that operate in this country today, nearly three quarters of those are located in towns with less than 20,000 people. Now, the rise of the organic food movement and sort of increased awareness of poultry welfare issues has led many middle-class consumers to exit the market for low-cost, mass-produced chicken over the last 15 years. Premium, locally sourced chickens are invariably raised in superior circumstances, but I think there's an unexamined assumption that that small farming operators, more commonly referred to as family farms, by necessity have better sort of labor conditions than large farming operators. I don't think that's always something that's really examined. Despite this sort of elite exodus from the McNugget market, from the fish stick market, the fast food chicken business continues to provide daily meals to millions of people. As the industry, an industry which was based largely on native-born workers in the 60s and 70s, turned to Central Americans in the 1980s, and now I think it's in the process of a sort of third phase whereby increasingly poultry plants are operated by people from countries like Somalia and Iraq. So it continues to operate day to day in service of, in service of sort of dietary and cultural assumptions that I'd like to think, matured in the 70s and 80s. The fitness and weight loss industries, they tend to grow in a symbiotic relationship, I think, with the development of processed foods. Not everyone eats McNuggets anymore, but they were born out of this period in which chicken took on the sort of central role as the primary protein source in the American diet. So in making sense of this and what created these ongoing challenges to public health, I think you need to look at processed chicken as a central part of this analysis. I'm happy to answer any questions on that.
Let me get this going. And first of all, let me ask you, if you haven't signed in, there are sign-up sheets that can circulate around the room. So it's all about chicken, obviously not beef. One thing I just have to, you know, I'm addicted to Arby's flatbread fish during this season. And they have a new sandwich that is every possible type of meat stacked on each other. So I guess the natural question, just for starters, is with the Baconator and all these other things that we've seen, I mean, it seems that we're more meat conscious today to a great degree. Maybe it's because of available money that people have. I'm not sure what it is, but any comment on that? I mean, we seem to be kind of meat crazy right now.
Right. I haven't yet tried this product, this sandwich. I think many of these restaurants have increasingly had to sort of change their image to sort of present pictures of, you know, chickens roaming in fields and cattle, sort of marching around pastures. There's been, you know, some move to sort of to sort of limit sort of mechanically reconstituted chicken, but I don't know the exact figure, but I think people have tried to estimate the number of different cows that are constituted in the average Big Mac, and it's like hundreds. The amount of beef that goes into the meat grinder, and you know, you've got about 100 different cows in that one paddy by the time it comes out. Vegetarianism's doing very well everywhere. I mean, you know, what was that? I don't know, 20 years ago, what, 1-2%? That seems to be on the rise. There's a whole industry in sort of meat substitutes now.
Okay, over here.
Did you go into a chicken processing plant?
I once went to a turkey plant in Utah, pretty similar. Yeah, pretty much the same, but bigger birds.
You're talking about this fabulous machine.
Yeah.
And if we are using, sort of low-paying labor
right
to run a machine like that, it must take some skills, you know? I always imagine they would be just using knives to
right
cut the chicken.
Right.
Or, are those machines common in those small towns that you described?
Most of them, the companies are sort of highly capitalized, so they can get access to this. There's a certain point at which, instead of removing the meat from the bone, they start essentially yanking out the bone from the meat, if you like.
So that's where we are now in the process.
That's kind of where we are. I mean, if you speak to someone from the poultry business, they'd say that the sort of injury rates have gone down. That like many of the most difficult jobs of like 20 or 30 years ago don't exist anymore. There used to be a job where you had to reach inside the bird, pull out the gallbladder without bursting the gallbladder, because if you burst it, then the chicken was spoiled. And it was this sort of motion like this every day. There's a machine that does that now. But as simple as you can make any operation, when you do it, say, 5,000 times a day, it's not healthy.
Yes.
We've been trying recently to figure out how much students eat at Georgetown compared to beef, and you know, we've got a really fairly small sample size based on what the guy in the warehouse told us they order every week, but the evidence suggests that while chicken is eaten more than beef by the sort of general population as a whole among young people. I mean, if you're sort of young and you want to, you know, maintain a healthy lifestyle without you're on a food plan which gives you a sort of limited set of options, and you want to maintain a sort of healthy lifestyle without becoming a vegetarian, that there aren't too many protein sources besides chicken. And so we found that the sort of chicken consumption among students at Georgetown is even more lopsided in favor of chicken over bacon and pork and beef than even the nation as a whole. But there's a small sample size. I'm still trying to prove that.
Other questions? Yes, Patrick, would you talk a little bit? Patrick recently published because I think that the question about what does it mean to work in a chicken plant. You recently published an article that really looked at the issue of who is the rural workforce, and so not only is there, I mean, as it's often been said, you know, if you actually you don't want to watch either legislation or sausage being made, is the old quote, right? So that there's a lot in effect that about the rural workforce and about kind of chicken production and any other slaughterhouse production that people don't really realize. You want to talk a little bit about the workforce?
Right, certainly. One of these things I've been looking at and trying to connect to sort of recent issues is the increasing degree to which, I mean, it's sometimes pretty hard to get people to work in your chicken plant. It's in the middle of nowhere in most cases. No one really wants to do it. And, you know, after like 3 months working there, you might have developed an injury that prevents you from doing so. Over the previous decade, I mean, we've seen since sort of 2008, the sort of, this is a bit debatable, but the degree to which people migrating from Central America has sort of declined and some people have gone back. Chicken plants, it seems, are increasingly depending upon refugees to work in the chicken plants. A lot of refugee sort of resettlement agencies. I mean, I'm trying to investigate. This is something I'm trying to investigate at the moment, and it might be a bit tricky because a lot of refugee resettlement agencies are run by churches, and you'd get the impression then that they were sort of based upon, you know, they were operating based upon people's donations every Sunday. But the refugee research, you know, they're not. They get paid by the federal government to essentially prepare people for work and put them into work. And in many cases, they're sort of compromised by the fact that they're putting them into dangerous jobs in sort of laundries in some cases, in warehouses, and in many cases in poultry plants. So people from the refugee resettlement agencies really don't seem to want to return my calls at the moment. I'm sort of looking into that some more. But no, I just sort of found it in sort of light of the discussion of the sort of travel ban. There was a lot of pushback to the idea of excluding refugees from war-torn countries from entering the United States, and many people said no, you know, we should absolutely allow them to enter the country. But there was a sort of question that, what happens after you enter the country? Now, no one seemed to really talk about that much. I mean, I think often, I mean, you can tell. I, I, I was born here, but many people, you know, who might be from sort of Irish or Polish or sort of, you know, Slovak or Russian descent, they might have a story about how their grandparent or great-grandparent came, and you know, when they came, they had to take the worst job, and you know, they sort of somehow struggled through it, and then, you know, they sort of made this sort of gradual climb up the ladder. And it might be sort of, I don't know, easy to sort of just sort of say, well, that's kind of a, treat it as a rite of passage, that if you first come here, then you that's what you have to do. But I think these jobs are dangerous, and if, you know, if you end up with a sort of, you know, chronic wrist condition, then it's pretty hard to climb any sort of a ladder, right? Metaphorical or...
But just to push you on that, Patrick, because in the article that you wrote, it's really about the fact that as much as, for example, because of President Trump's win in a lot of rural districts,
right,
in reality, those rural districts are not as kind of monochromatic white as one might imagine, because right, many of those small towns, as you said, are extremely populated by Somalis and others who are actually working in those right, chicken plants. Is that correct?
Yes, I think so, and I think there's other cases where, in cases where plants might be employing people without documentation, these are communities that don't show up on the voter rolls. They don't even necessarily show up on the census. You've got, you know, if you look at, you know, a township that has like 96 people on the census, and it's got an enormous poultry plant there, then like, well, where the hell, you know, it takes more than 96. Like, they can't all be working in there. So I think there's a lot of people, you know, living in kind of in the shadows that that make up part of rural diversity, that make up in some strange way sometimes part of these communities, but isn't necessarily accounted for by the election, isn't necessarily accounted for by the census either.
Other questions? I guess I'm curious about one thing, and I'm sure that the animal studies people might be interested in this too. Can you talk a little bit about your research and what it tells you about how workers look at the, in effect, the animals that they slaughter? Or is there a kind of a changing relationship between a worker and his or her feelings about, in effect, meat and other things that are produced in this industry?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I've sort of heard that, you know, I've sort of heard and met and seen people anecdotally who've explained to me that having worked in one of those places, they'd never eat the subject of that. There was a pie factory in my hometown, and no one wanted to work in the pie factory. It was just gross. I never got in there, but everyone who worked in the pie factory said they never wanted to eat like meat pies again. Sometimes I think this is where you get a bit of a sort of conflict between the animal rights side of things and the sort of labor side of things. Sometimes the companies are particularly conscious at the moment of people from groups like PETA going in with hidden cameras and seeing sort of chickens mistreated. You'll see, there are videos online where you sort of see people sort of throwing them and sort of like not entirely dead chickens sort of left on the side of things. I think it's in some ways a dehumanizing process. So this is a slight anecdote, but I worked in this parcel warehouse once, and you're meant to, you know, the first day they said, be very careful with the parcels, don't break anything. Well, you know, they're coming along this belt, and you're meant to take them off the belt, and then you put them in the right pile, and you know, so it goes along. But as the sort of amount of parcels coming down go along, you get a bit rougher. And then suddenly, like, you know, one of my parcels is up there, so I've had to run down this end and get that, and you know, the only way I can get that and then stop my next parcel, which is already passing, is by, you know, throwing it this way and throwing it that way, and I didn't treat all of these parcels so good by the end of it. I was just trying to keep up with, like, this really fast conveyor belt of parcels that was flying by, and I think, you know, I think the same happens in poultry plants with chickens, and after a while, whether it's before, whether it's alive or dead, it's meat, and it gets treated as such.
Okay. Other questions or comments for Patrick? Linda?
Well, I'm just going off on the repetitive nature of that kind of work. Is that kind of work. Some studies have documented that the rate of social disorganization in areas that have slaughterhouses is very high, so that the repetitive nature of that kind of work and the kind of cognitive dissonance that goes on in separating oneself from the horror anguish of killing every day spills over into the broader community. This kind of work is similar, that slaughterhouses are similar to other kinds of repetitive work, such as the factory that you
right.
just described.
The biggest company in the world to produce poultry is no longer American, it's a Brazilian company called JBS. And a lot of chicken produced in Brazil, and there's some interesting sort of studies there looking at the sort of long-term psychological impacts of not just working on a production line, but working on something which I guess involves, you know, a sort of life and then death process, that particularly the... you know, if your job, most of the, you know, you used to, someone would the chicken would die because someone would take a knife and cut its throat. Most of the sort of actual slaughter operations are done by machinery now. So there's not one person cutting necks day in, day out. But nevertheless, I think the sort of long-term psychological implications of that, some people might be really tough, but that's the sort of interesting area that needs more exploration.
I'm curious what your next research project is.
In terms of this, I really want to nail those immigration agencies. I want to try and find out more about this the way in which refugee agencies operate. There's a company called, I think, Golden Plump in Minnesota, which is almost entirely run by Somalis. And I think they've been trying to institute so that they're allowed to stop the line to pray at different points in the day, because it's an almost entirely Muslim workforce. And I'm interested in trying to get up there and find out more about that. But this, as far as this subject's concerned.
Understand might be a better word than nail. You said nail with immigration.
Yeah, understand, sorry, yeah. Yeah, understand.
Strategically speaking, I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Explain, understand, illuminate, you know.
That seems like useful work.
Now, one thing in your story, you know, the rise of the fast food industry and everything else, I think that this is correct, Linda might know, that one of our egg producers, I believe out in the DeWitt area or further along 96, if I remember rightly, they said that it's either an egg producer or a chicken producer, but it produces, you know, like the majority of eggs for McDonald's for the entire, you know, west of the Mississippi, you know, it was like this outrageous figure. Mm. So you get kind of centralization, because not only the rise of kind of horizontal integration of all those McDonald's,
right,
but also the relationship with key producers, like in the mm-hmm. case of potatoes, the Simplot family in mm-hmm. Idaho does all of the potatoes now for McDonald's. So, I mean, that has a huge effect, I assume, on the actual production of chicken and everything else, like you mentioned Tyson and the other kind of producers.
Right. Yeah, I think sort of geographical selection of locations has been You know, there's a reason they're not here in Michigan, mostly, you know, like southern climates provided sort of year-round production. Chickens don't lay eggs so much when it's snowing in April, you know, when it's cold out. So, you know, North Carolina, Arkansas, Georgia were very popular, and, you know, there's sort of soil sciences that you can also talk about, but...
Okay. Any last questions for Patrick about chicken or chicken workers or beef, since we heard so much about beef today as well? Okay. Well, please help me give Patrick one last round of applause. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I appreciate your coming.